Let's begin tonight with the homage and the three refuges. Whoever loves himself will never harm another. If this is true, then we can see, just looking around at the events in the world, that there are many who do not love, who do not have love for self. It has been said that, particularly in this country, that in fact there is much self-loathing. Even if this phenomenon is peculiar to this country, it certainly will not just remain here. What begins here usually spreads around the world in no time. American culture, both good and bad, permeates all corners of the globe like water saturating a paper towel. This is why the metta practice focused first on self and then extending to loved ones, close friends, neutral persons, difficult people, enemies, and to all beings is important. Loving kindness is an antidote to hatred and anger. I have used metta on a number of occasions in my work in dealing with angry, agitated people. I work in a prison. People there are angry and agitated often. As I send metta to a person, to an inmate who is walking through my doors, I become more settled, much less affected by the other person's agitation. When I am more settled and centered, there's less of a chance for the situation to escalate. I know that if there are two of us in the room, I'm at least 50% responsible for the kind of energy in that room. And having a calm, peaceful presence, there is a space that's created to allow anger to go into, spread out, and dissipate. When we create space, we can hold more. The fundamental nature of humans is the wish to be free, the wish to be happy. Practicing metta puts one in touch with that basic nature. It is a mindful experience which points to the reality that we are all connected and that how we treat one another can have profound effects. I'd like to read a poem called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. Karuna, or compassion. It's not about pity. It's not being overcome by grief. In fact, grief is the near enemy of compassion. It is the near enemy because it can look a lot like compassion. Compassion has sometimes been described as a quivering of the heart. It's nice. A quivering of the heart. Quivering of the heart in response to a being's suffering or pain. So whereas metta addresses the wish for the well-being of another, compassion is the quality of mind which responds to the suffering of another. To develop compassion, we must first be mindful and open enough to recognize that there is suffering. The First Noble Truth points this out. And when you think about it, it seems obvious. However, too often this realization is pushed not only aside, but completely out of our awareness, often to the point of denial, which is delusion. Millions upon millions of dollars are spent on research alone on how to effectively take away from you one of your most important resources, one of your most valuable possessions. What is it? Those who have been in my groups know, because I've talked about it. What is it? It's your attention. We're constantly being bombarded by advertisements and enticements of all sorts through email, snail mail, radio, TV, the billboards and signs. Unfortunately, they do a very good job. Consequently, we all too often are blinded by the bright lights and the beautiful people that we are exposed to on the screens, while our shadow is hidden away. In psychological terms, denial is called a defense mechanism. Yeah, there is an all-out offense against the reality of life if we don't guard against that. Sharon Salzberg's book is aptly subtitled "The Revolutionary Art of Happiness." What you're doing is revolutionary. It is revolutionary or radical when you take back your attention. When you take back your mind and your life, that's radical. To break the bondage of slavery is freedom. Sister Rachel talked about practicing freedom for 25 years. And that's what we're doing here. Slavery presents itself in many different ways, from commercialism to internalized oppression to plain old dukkha. When you have your own attention, you can see through delusion and know that there is suffering. Compassion is not always so nice and soft, and certainly not wimpy. Just ask Martin Luther King or Gandhi. Gandhi, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, Thurgood Marshall, Harriet Tubman, and the Berrigan brothers are just a few examples of those warriors who expressed the courage to open to the suffering of others and to act to relieve their suffering. They overcame their own fears to deal with the faraway enemy of compassion, which is cruelty. And they did it in such a beautiful way, peacefully. Just as we did not fail to include ourselves in the practice of metta, it is important to do the same in the practice of compassion. For most of us, it was our suffering which brought us to this practice. It is our compassion for ourselves as well as for others which can bring us to freedom. Martin Luther King said, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing that it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you murder the hater, but you do not murder the hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." Sympathetic joy, mudita. This means to have a sense of gladness, rejoicing in the happiness and joy of others. We've probably experienced this to some degree with the people we love. Parents tend to feel happy when their son or daughter is happy. For a parent, the greatest wish is for their child to be happy. You know, you've heard parents say, oh, and you've probably done this yourself, oh, I don't care what you do. I don't care if you become you don't have to become a doctor, a lawyer, or a president, or anything, just as long as you're happy. Sympathetic joy. The question is, can we feel joy for the success of others that we may not be so close to? Can we feel joy for those difficult people who are experiencing joy? Sharon writes, Salzberg writes, because there are so many conflicting mind states that are impediments to mudita, sympathetic joy, is considered the most difficult of all the Brahma Viharas to develop. But so potent is this quality that expressing it can defeat the aversion and attachment that bind us. Can we feel the joy for another? Can we feel the joy when another is experiencing joy? Some of those mind states that are competing and conflicting are judgment, comparing, which separates us and creates competition, prejudice. Now, I guess it's okay to root for the Boston Red Sox, you know, and enjoy the joy that they had after winning the World Series. And, you know, who cares about the Yankees anyway, right? Sorry. Envy is another. Selfishness and boredom. The supporters of mudita, rapture, allowing ourselves to feel the joy, and compassion. The path is not difficult for those who don't pick and choose. The path is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Equanimity, upeka. Equanimity means impartiality or evenness. This is not indifference, devoid of pleasure or pain. Stupid indifference is, as it is called, is the near enemy of equanimity. Just not caring for the obvious suffering of others. It's indifference, stupid indifference. The far enemy is attraction or revulsion. We all experience unhappiness or pain. And we all experience pleasure. These two, they come and go constantly. We chase after one and try to push the other away. When neither is present, there is neutrality. It is not a matter of shutting out feeling to them, but can we experience the pleasure without clinging to it or craving for it? Can we experience pain or unpleasant experiences without reacting with aversion by pushing it away? When the experience is neutral, can we be fully alive and awake? Awake to it without being bored or falling asleep? Sloth and torpor? As I often say to myself, embrace all things, attached to none. Embrace all things, attached to none. Equanimity is often taught as the final meditation among the Brahma Viharas because it provides the balance for loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. Loving kindness says, may you be happy. Compassion says, may you be free from suffering. Sympathetic joy says, may your joy never cease. Equanimity balances those sentiments, those wishes, with the understanding that despite our wishes, things are the way they are. The equanimity meditation is, all beings are owners of their own karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depend on their actions, not on my wishes for them. There is strength gained from the answer the Dalai Lama gave when asked, do you have any peers? The Dalai Lama said, yes, everyone. It's heavy. That's heavy. Can we aspire to think on that level? That everyone is my peer. Equanimity in the workplace is extraordinarily important where I work. It is needed in dealing with the man who is demanding and probably needing care for anxiety and insomnia, who has brutally assaulted and crippled a storekeeper who was only trying to earn her living. How do you deal with the man on death row who is just hours away from his death, who needs to have you bring him some medication to calm his nerves just before his execution? A man who brutally murdered a little girl. Or the member of the Aryan Brotherhood who hates all blacks and browns, who was just brought to your office to receive treatment for his depression. Equanimity gives power and brings to life the practices of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, because it is not attached to outcome. Sometimes our best is not good enough to bring about the changes we would have hoped for. It's okay if we've done our best. The wish for another to be happy is fueled by equanimity. The courage which is required for compassion to move into action is fueled by equanimity. And that rapture which is needed to feel another's joy is fueled by equanimity. With equanimity, we're not overrun by the sorrows of the world. We can stand in the suffering without falling into the abyss of denial or the deadly labyrinth of grief. I'd like to end with another poem called Enough. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. Let's sit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.